This episode of Connect the Dots is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. Our podcast is supported in part by the Center on Environment, Land, and Law at Loyola University, New Orleans. Our lives revolve around the weather, what we wear, where our kids play after school, where we go on vacation, the hobbies we take up, and where we choose to live and work. Even what foods are available are often weather dependent. You know, something as silly as whether we can get avocados on a taco could be dependent on whatever hand that a farmer was dealt that spring. With the climate crisis, the weather we know is changing dramatically and our lives are going to follow suit. Last summer, for example, 1 in 3 Americans were affected by climate-related disasters. Heat waves we know are on the rise. The number of days with temperatures above 120 degrees has nearly doubled in the past 40 years. In fact, 300 million people now live under heat stress conditions. Depending upon where you live, it's no longer safe to send your kid out in the yard sometimes before dinner. Now, due to uncertainty like this and these ominous conditions, some people are even deciding not to have kids. Some of my own students have told me that. The thought of parenting is bringing more stress than it used to in the past. What world will young people inherit? What lives will they lead? And how soon are all these changes coming? From our vacations to after-school playdates, we all must adapt our lifestyles for the winds of climate change, and some adjustments are going to be easier than others.
The results of climate projections like the ones I create are incredibly grave and incredibly sobering, but it's an entirely different sort of level of surprise when you find yourself directly experiencing one of these extreme weather events or even just being on the fringes of it.
One of the main things that we're really concerned about with climate change is the rate of change. Everything changes, right? But the rate of change is so extraordinary.
It's tough because you don't want to spoil the experience. You don't want your child to go out into nature and view it as being sick.
You know, we cannot shut travel down, but we need to restart travel in a more wise way. That calls for accessibility and affordability.
You're listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. On today's episode, Life and Leisure, we consider what aspects of our lives are going to change now and down the road because of the climate crisis. And we'll try to take advantage of any silver linings. I read an article recently claiming that climate change ruins summer. That's what it said. From wildfires and hurricanes to extreme heat conditions, a lot of popular destinations for seasonal travel are becoming less desirable. South Lake Tahoe was evacuated because of fires. My sister lives there, and I remember when she had to pack up. In California, 1.76 million acres went to flame. The state closed all its national forests. Similarly, in Minnesota, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, that's located up in Superior National Forest, shut down because of extreme fire danger. In other areas across the country, toxic algal blooms ruined hundreds of lakes, rivers, and beaches. Lakes in the West, they're drying up. Vacations aren't the only thing at risk. Extreme weather affects exercise habits and outdoor group activities. School recess, youth athletic leagues, neighborhood get-togethers, they're all subject to the Earth's seemingly eruptive temper. We can see this impact in sporting events, too. Just last summer at the Tokyo Olympic Games, athletes took new precautions against the heat. Think about what we eat. Rising temperatures affect crop production from the West Coast all the way to the Mediterranean, where olive oil producers have noticed a decline in quality over the past few years. Apple growers across the United States faced a 19% drop in supply in June 2021 compared with June 2020. With temperature swings, windstorms, wildfires, and polar vortexes destroying a season of crops and entire farms, sometimes within minutes. And then there are animals already vulnerable and facing new challenges. Red-bellied woodpeckers are flying northward. I spend part of my summer every year on Whidbey Island, which is in Washington State. And over the summers of the last few years, we've started to see large flocks of white pelicans. We never had those before. They're beautiful. But the reason they're there is because their normal summer grounds are a collection of wetlands in Oregon, and they've all dried up. The feet of lizards have adapted to grasp twigs and branches during severe storms. Alaskan grizzly bears are eating more berries than they are salmon. In the oceans, acidification dissolves the protective shells of mollusks, and some species of fish that rely on water chemistry for navigation have lost their sensory capacities. The extent to which our lives are going to change because of climate disruption is, of course, unknown, and it's going to depend on where we live and what we do. I talked with Dr. Kimberly Miner, a scientist and systems engineer at NASA Jet Propulsion Lab in California, about this subject. Kimberly researches and forecasts climate risks around the world. And incidentally, she's also a certified wilderness firefighter.
Well, I think both global warming and human encroachment, myself and a lot of my generation, I think, feel this deep sense of loss where we look at, you know, the wild spaces that we had in our childhoods or the, you know, regular rain patterns or the regular snowfall that was the certain quality and texture and really the huge differences that you're seeing now with the whole wild land around where I grew up in Colorado now covered in houses. You know, you can see a pollution layer everywhere you go from every airplane. That wasn't the case even when I was growing up. The quality of the interactions with nature for me, even I think have decreased, and you don't get regular rainstorms. You don't get to see the birds playing in the puddles. There's a lot of differences that have happened so quickly. And that's one of the main things that we're really concerned about with climate change is the rate of change. Everything changes, right? But the rate of change is so extraordinary.
In some ways, it depends on what you're accustomed to. And there are young people now whose idea of what's normal are different from my generation's. They don't remember a time when wildfires and hurricanes weren't a constant threat or when it wasn't terribly hot all summer. They also have a fear I didn't have to worry about.
Every generation's baseline is a little different, right? So what my grandparents, their relationship with the natural world is so different than mine, because by the time I was born, a number of species had disappeared. The vegetation structure may have been different. It's hard to notice, but it's potentially all around us. So I think that it really builds this sense of, like I said, this sense of loss where, you know, there's something missing, but you can't put your finger on it because you're not really sure what you're missing. I'm a AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, if then ambassador. So there's 125 of us scientists who were chosen to be liaisons to a younger generation and have had a diversity of opportunities to speak to younger generations, whether it's on TikTok, I was on a CBS TV show, on Twitter, whatever the venue is. They know about climate change. They are concerned about climate change. Some of them are very concerned about climate change, depending on their age group, right? Maybe the older kids are a little bit more knowledgeable. And everyone's really looking for answers. The so what? What's going to happen next? How do I plan my life? Can I have kids? Where should I buy a house? You know, these questions that I think maybe we've taken for granted as a society for a couple of generations are really being essentially questioned as people are trying to plan out their next steps for the future.
It's hard planning for the future these days. On our last episode, we talked about buying a home and the various climate risks that must be addressed when considering a location. Jobs could change, markets could change, even social structures. In 2021, analysts at Morgan Stanley researched how anxiety over climate change affected fertility rates. They cited a study conducted by researchers at UCLA showing the number of births in the United States fell in the 9 months after an extreme heat event, while a study of 18,000 couples in China last year showed that climate change and specifically pollution from smoke particles was associated with a 20% increased likelihood of infertility. They also noted that having a child contributed substantially to carbon dioxide emissions. All this created a lot of existential angst. And as a result, people are deciding not to have kids. Kimberly Miner can relate.
I'm very much in the camp of not having children. I think there's lots of children that need to be loved. And so we are planning on fostering and adopting. And that is definitely part of my calculation, is what kind of life that child would have versus the kind of life that I have. And I do talk to students about my perspective on it. It's a personal choice, right? What people do with their bodies is their choice. The other thing is, I don't think that it right now is irrevocable. I think that we do have a little bit of time. I think that we can always make things better for those around us. And by that, I do mean as well the plants, the animals, the ecosystems around us. You know, we've got native plants growing out on our balcony and a little bowl of water for the bees. And I try to take steps to be kind to all of the different kinds of organisms around me. And that's how I really keep going, is keeping that focus on the individual, and whether it's the individual hummingbirds that come to our feeder or the relationships I have with other humans. But it's hard. It's really, really hard. And sometimes I do get really discouraged and need the support of my community to keep going.
Like Kimberly, Lowell Chandler took the climate crisis into consideration when deciding whether he wanted to start a family. Lowell's an environmental lawyer out in Montana who has also worked as a climate analyst in Washington, D.C. He brings up the dissonance of past and present experiences and a longing for what once was his great outdoors.
My family and I would go to the Klamath River about every summer from 1995 to 2000. Do a little fishing, mainly kayaking. We would usually camp for a week or two in that area, the Rogue River, Trinity River area as well. Particularly the Klamath River was one thing that really signaled to me that there was a problem when it comes to climate change and how we as humans are interacting with our environment. We kind of took a hiatus for a few years, and around like 2003 or 4, we went back, and the water quality of the river had changed pretty drastically, as well as the quantity. I think climate change had an impact on that, not only due to the drought in the river basin, but also the increasing temperatures of the river itself, leading to more algae blooms and other issues associated with hotter water.
Lowell has a young son, and he wants to make sure that his children grow up with an awareness and respect for the environment, and that they protect it for the future. Climate disruption was something that weighed heavily on his mind when deciding to have children with his partner, and now it's become a factor in how they parent.
We've definitely discussed how to, one, make sure our son grows up being informed and prepared in terms of being resilient to the major changes and disruptions that he'll undoubtedly face due to runaway climate change throughout his life, but also trying to prepare him emotionally and psychologically for the trauma associated with runaway climate change through educating him about the causes of climate change and the likely impacts and what the impacts have been just from my childhood to now and what that means for us as a family and him as an individual. It's tough because you don't want to spoil the experience. You don't want your child to go out into nature and view it as being sick. It's kind of a balance of not placing too many stressors on him and too big of a burden on him. He's already been exposed to some of the issues just in his short life. For example, last summer, it wasn't too smoky summer for Montana standards, but this summer, it was one of the worst summers In terms of smoke, I've experienced, particularly with sustained air quality issues due to the smoke, and which are largely caused or exacerbated by climate change. It's been kind of the first lesson for him of, hey, the air quality is really bad. I have an app that tells us the air quality, and it has a face on it that's frowny if it's bad, and say, look, see it, see the guy's face? It's a frowny face. We got to stay inside today. That was most of July this year and a good portion of August as well. It's just unfortunate because he loves to be outside, and to tell him we can't go outside, he doesn't really quite grasp why.
Christy Dahl is a senior climate scientist for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. There, she translates climate analyses for the general public and for policymakers. She believes that climate will soon be a factor in nearly all the decisions that we make, starting with where we live.
We all have a lot of concerns and a lot of reasons for settling in the places we do, you know, whether that's job opportunities or needing to be close to family or wanting to be closer to family. So climate would certainly play into my decision making. Wherever you are in this country, in the coming decades, you will be experiencing climate change in one form or another. Naturally, we all look at the job opportunities that are available, the education opportunities that your children would have. Factor climate change in there too, right? How many times will I have to deal with flooding if I move to this community? How many times will I have to have the air conditioning on all summer long? You know, there's no one place that is going to be immune to these kinds of changes. It really comes down to the risks that you're willing to live with and how those fit in with the suite of other opportunities you're hoping to gain by moving.
There are constraints beyond housing, like Lowell mentioned, where you spend your leisure time, how you keep your kids active, what you do for vacation, or how you socialize.
If you live in the northeast of the U.S. or the northwest, and you're used to relatively moderate summers, those summers are going to become a lot hotter. And so the things that you've typically done during the summer, whether it's afternoon barbecues with your neighbors or opening the doors and just letting your kids out to play all day, are going to become less possible and less safe. The same holds true for things like wildfires. In California, where I live, we're looking at a major increase in the size of wildfires and the amount of land that burns. And so that's going to influence the choices people can make about how to interact with our beautiful natural environment.
Community dynamics will also shift. The days of rolling around in the mud and building forts in the yard might be over for some people in some places.
I live in California. For the past 5 years or so, we have been dealing with incredible amounts of wildfire smoke. Last year, for example, there was a full week when my husband and I didn't let our kids go outdoors. It was so bad in terms of the air quality. The Pacific Northwest heat wave this past summer was so hot that my own research wouldn't have predicted that kind of event even at the end of this century. What we're seeing is that these changes, this intensification of extreme weather events, is unfolding much more quickly than we had anticipated as scientists. And I have been surprised at my own emotional reaction to living in this climate reality that I long knew intellectually was possible, but somehow didn't connect it to how it would affect my life in particular. The science is the science, and the results of climate projections like the ones I create are incredibly grave and incredibly sobering. But it's an entirely different sort of level of surprise when you find yourself directly experiencing one of these extreme weather events, even just being on the fringes of it.
We've talked a lot about how our lives will be altered by climate change, but not necessarily about the ways that we can adapt and support the planet. I was recently introduced to a company called Good Wings, which is a platform for businesses and consumers to book sustainable travel. With Good Wings, anyone can book a hotel, It's the same as what you do on any other travel platform, and there are deals available. When you select a hotel, Good Wings calculates the carbon footprint of your entire trip, from the flight emissions to transportation, even energy use and meals. And then it offsets it through one of its certified resources that removes carbon from the air. Members pay a small fee to the part of the network, but otherwise there are no additional costs. I spoke with the founder and CEO, Christian Müller-Holst, who explained in more detail.
Basically, the whole idea behind Good Wings comes out of the fact that we are not going to travel zero emission, at least not long distance, within the next 15 to 20 years. So aviation and travel as such is going to continue to emit X gigatons of carbon dioxide every year, causing climate change. Everyone expects that once we have learned how to live with COVID, we're going to see travel returning full force. That means emissions are coming back full force too. Nobody wants to pay a premium to compensate or remove their emissions. We want to enable people, businesses, and individuals to return to travel in a way that at least helps mitigate climate change. We don't pretend to have developed a hydrogen airplane or something like that. In our view, when something is carbon neutral or net zero, you calculate how much CO2 you're pumping into the atmosphere and you remove that same amount. So you can do that either through nature-based solutions like planting trees, mangroves, etc., or you can do it through technologies like direct air capture, where you're literally sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere. We use those technologies to remove emissions. That is anywhere between 6 and 60 times more expensive than the typical carbon offsetting. We use our entire booking revenue to pay for the removal of your emissions. We charge you a relatively small subscription fee for individuals. I believe it's around $49 per year per person. For a company, it's anywhere between $500 and $2,000 per year per business. So it's very affordable for both individuals and businesses to become a member.
The fee is low and the payoff is big. And as Christian points out, even people who care about the environment are on a budget. So it's more appealing than some of the alternatives.
Our studies show that even the most climate conscious people are not paying a premium to travel more responsible, because traveling responsible means, in my view, removing emissions. And doing so is quite expensive. If you want to make net zero travel mainstream, if you want to impact the way that people travel and change the way people travel, you need to come up with a business model that can afford to cover that cost on behalf of the clients. We try to educate our clients on what is net zero and why is net zero the way that we must travel going forward. It's part of the booking experience, so you don't need to change your behavior.
For businesses concerned with environmental, social, and governance ratings and corporate responsibility, Good Wings provides another way to hit those marks, and also it saves a company the time and effort it would typically spend calculating and offsetting its carbon footprint.
There's a cultural shift going on. There's also a shift in paradigm. So companies and business leaders are not necessarily looking for a green travel solution because it's good for the bottom line, but also because they want to take climate action. Internally, because they want to signal and demonstrate that they are a climate conscious business, that enables them to attract and retain talents.
Good Wings has a goal of making 1 billion trips net zero by 2030. Saving the air 100 million tons of carbon dioxide. In addition, they plan to expand beyond hotels into transportation sources like trains and buses. Now, there are other venues out there seeking solutions too. In addition, there are sites that help travelers find greener options for vacations, offering eco-friendly hotels and destination cities. A study released last year found that 4 in 5 people want to travel more responsibly in the future because of the pandemic, and 72% said travel should support local communities and economies. That is, of course, if such trips don't inconvenience them very much. Countering emissions costs money, and a lot of people don't have those extra dollars at their disposal. That's where Good Wings found a gap in the chain.
We want to mobilize and democratize green solutions. Because if you look at sustainable travel per se, it has up until now and still is a very sustainable hotel in the Maldives offering you plant-based food. You know, it couldn't be more unsustainable. You know, what really is sustainable is traveling less. And when you do travel, take full responsibility for the, for your footprint. That is costly. First of all, most people don't know how to do it, as we talked about earlier, and also are not willing to pay that $80 premium to remove the emissions from a family of four. Very fundamental to us is we want to democratize a way of traveling that is in harmony with our climate worries and conscience. 350 million people's lives depend on the travel and tourism sector. You know, we cannot shut travel down, but we need to restart travel in a more wise way. That calls for accessibility and affordability. So that is really fundamental to us. We want to make it accessible, easy, and affordable for all to make a small change that literally completely changes the footprint.
We've now found a way to enjoy vacations with a cleaner or greener conscience, and it does seem there are increasingly more options available for that. What about the other things we enjoy, though? What about spending time with our friends and family? There are steps that we can take to adapt to the changing planet and still discover those idyllic summers from the past. For people like Kimberly Miner, it's about changing leisure practices to make a difference. Playing outside, but doing it with purpose by tending to a garden, joining neighborhood trash pickups, or visiting countries off the grid. This could also lead to better outcomes down the road.
I always encourage the kids I talk to plant a garden of any size because it is such a wonderful way to interact with the world around you. We can do big things. We can, you know, run or participate in tree planting or ocean cleanups or, you know, talking to representatives. I always encourage kids to talk to their parents about their issues, their thoughts, their concerns. So I think there's lots of different levels of what we can do that is helpful, but also makes us feel a little tiny bit better in the face of this growing calamity. And I also am contacted by a lot of young people who are interested in going into the field in some capacity, whether it's communicating science or becoming a scientist themselves. People are very motivated and very driven to be a part of the solution and be a part of this building momentum towards doing good work towards preserving the planet.
In Montana, Lowell Chandler has adapted his household to best suit the shifting climate. Even in a state that seems somewhat removed from the crisis, extreme disasters require change at all levels.
There's nowhere that's immune to the climate change impacts. Everywhere you look, there's something happening that's not ideal from a habitability perspective. And here in Helena, we don't have to worry about flooding too much, at least where we're located. But we do have to worry about wildfires, drought, water shortages. Just for example, this past summer, the city of Helena had to institute stage 3 water restrictions, just basically to prioritize the city's municipal water supply, cutting off all water usage outside. No more water for gardens, lawns, no car washing, obviously. And then there's another stage that's a little bit less than that, which we were in for most of the summer, which was odd homes can only water outside on odd days, and even homes can only water outside on even days. I spoke with some longtime Helena residents about that, and they said that was the first time that they've seen those water restrictions come in. They've lived in Helena for 30 plus years, and some even longer than 40 or so. I ride my bike a lot to work, and I drop my son off at his school on my bike, and it was interesting to see in the mornings riding to work which houses were complying and which ones weren't. But there was no real enforcement. It wasn't an enforcement type deal where the city was willing to force people to change their habit. That's one issue that's I think is going to become increasingly problematic just in terms of people's defiance to acting as a community and acting positively to ensure that we all have enough resources to survive. It seems that more and more these days, everyone thinks they're entitled to do whatever they want, despite reality.
Oh, we all know people averse to change. We're all comfortable with patterns, routines, normalcy. The thing is, as Lowell points out, reality has shifted. Our patterns no longer work. And if we can start with simple steps now, we'll avoid more unnerving alternatives down the road. Water your lawn on the odd days. Pay a small fee to see the world. And find ways to connect with each other on shared experiences, concerns, and opportunities. As Christy Dahl suggests, communication makes all the difference. We all have to talk to one another more about climate change. And surveys show we don't do it because it makes us feel nervous. But just as important, we have to talk to people about things they can relate to, things they care about.
When I communicate to just friends and acquaintances about climate change, I'm often trying to connect around the things that we are experiencing in common, and then connecting the dots from there to the broader trends that we're seeing on a scientific and sort of geological timescale. For me, connecting with other folks in California around the wildfire smoke that we're exposed to every fall, because that's something people feel and experience very viscerally here. I think there's a wide range of physical and emotional effects. For some folks, they might experience that immediate effect of wildfire smoke as exacerbating an underlying respiratory condition like asthma. If you're exposed to that smoke chronically, it does have detrimental impacts on your health. The same may hold true for something like exposure to flooding. We know that in the aftermath of flooding, people's homes can become infested with mold, and that has negative health impacts on the people living in that home. So then you think about the emotional impacts of having to repeatedly evacuate from your home or from your community year after year because of hurricanes or wildfires or floods. That all takes a toll on our mental health and well-being.
And with the millions of young people working around the globe to raise attention on this issue, the next generation is proving to be more willing to adapt and shift their lifestyles to spend money on better travel and reduced water usage, for instance. Those habits can be instilled now by parents if you choose to take on the mission.
We're not willing to give up, and we really think it's important that we have a generation of informed minds who can make a positive change. We can't give up. We need to still hang on to hope, keep fighting the good fight, and make sure there's a generation after us that has that same mentality.
Thanks for listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For information on this episode, please visit our website, progressivereform.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at CPRblog. Or follow us on Instagram at Progressive Reform, all one word. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review. It'll help us reach more people like you who want to connect the dot on today's most pressing issues. I'd like to thank our guests today, Kimberly Miner, Lowell Chandler, Christy Dahl, and Christian Mueller-Holst, as well as our producer, Courtney Garcia, and our assistant producer, Maggie Duane. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions. And I'm Rob Virchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.